Thank you, Kendrick. I'm excited to talk to you guys today because I expect you probably don't get a lot of exoplanet talks here. So it's sort of a privilege to be able to give an overview of the field and you know, how my work fits in that. So this is what I work on. You know, there's a lot of things having to do with planets and stars and exoplanets here, but what I want you to sort of keep in mind throughout this talk is that, you know, the methods and tools that I use to do this research are pretty much applicable to any field of science that interacts with data in any way. So that sort of, you know, exoplanets are sort of the excuse to do the to use these tools. So one sort of way, a kind of cartoon way to think about science that, you know, sort of came up with here is this projection in this particular space. And scientific progress can be thought of as kind of moving through this space in different ways. So you can imagine, you know, purely theoretical work that's using mathematics to, you know, move straight upwards. You can also imagine somebody in their backyard with a telescope taking images of the sky and, you know, putting them up on her wall as a, you know, artwork, but not doing any theoretical science with it. But sort of more the kind of guts of what scientific progress often is this sort of tension, struggle to reconcile the theory with the data. And so these things working together. And you know, you might have an experiment where you get lots of data and that kind of confirms what you already knew about or what you already expected about the universe and this kind of refining knowledge moving and sort of up into the right direction. Or sometimes you get data from a study and it sort of changes what you thought was true about the universe. And so it you know, sort of moved down into the right. The more data you get, the less you realize you understand about what there is to know. And sort of thinking about putting this talk together, what I realized is that, you know, there are a lot of people here who think about cosmology, and cosmology and exoplanets have taken, you know, these two very different trajectories in the last couple decades, where you know, a lot of the cosmological studies have been, you know, for example, Planck has, you know, tightened all the parameters of our cosmological model. You know, and a lot of, you know, so cosmology is kind of moving in that direction. And the more we find out about exoplanets, the more we realize we don't understand theoretically about, you know, how planets form, how they evolve, and, you know, sort of what is the space of things that need to be explained. So I think this is just kind of a fun little cartoon here. So getting back to what it is that I do, if I were to actually kind of summarize my research in a single word, that word is not, would not be exoplanets. And that word is actually not even any of the words that are up on this slide, because I apparently don't use it in my abstracts very often, but that's inference. And what inference is, it's the sort of formal way that data and theory interact with one another. And this can take different different flavors. You know, this is you know, what inference looks like. You might have a physical model of a particular astrophysical scenario, and you get data of this, you know, related to this, and you use that to try to, you know, figure out what are the parameters of that theory. So, you know, the cosmic microwave background and cosmology is a perfect example of this. You also might have a situation where you have multiple different models that are competing to try to explain the same data. And in that case, you might have to, you know, ask your data which model do these data prefer, and this is also an example of a different kind of inference. So pretty much all the research that I'm going to talk about today has to do in some measure with this problem of inference. So moving on to planets, you know, when I said that there was a high theoretical understanding of planetary systems in, you know, the early 90s, what that meant is that we did a really good job of explaining the solar system. You know, we knew that there were rocky planets on short period orbits, and then as you get farther out, you get gas giants and ice giant planets. And we had good explanations of how these planets should have formed. What we didn't know was you know, are there other planetary systems around other stars? It's kind of crazy to think about now that, you know, just 25 years ago, we didn't actually know if our solar system was the only solar system in the galaxy. Looking back on it, it's probably makes sense that that wouldn't necessarily be the case from a sort of a Copernican worldview. But we didn't actually know that. So there were people who were out to try to find other solar systems. Thanks for that light. But this is sort of a fringe area of astronomy. And what these people were looking for were essentially Jupiter. So Jupiter is the most detectable planet in our solar system. And in order to look for Jupiters around other stars, people are taking advantage of the fact that when a planet orbits a star, you know, that both the planet and the star are orbiting the common center of mass. And what that results in is the star is actually doing a little tiny orbit around this common center of mass that's far inside of the star. And for the case of Jupiter and the sun, the velocity at which the sun is orbiting due to the pull of Jupiter is about 10 meters per second. And I always find it, in astronomy, astrophysics, we're sort of inundated by these ridiculous numbers of like 10 to the 30 and all these things that are completely nonsensical to the sort of like common understanding. But the fact that there's like an astrophysically relevant velocity that's also a terrestrial relevant velocity, like I can walk or run at the speeds that these stars move around, that we can actually measure them. I find that to be pretty fascinating.
10 meters per second.
I said walk or run. it's fast. It's fast. But, you know, we're sensitive to, you know, 1 and 2 meters per second now these days. So we have... So when people were looking for Jupiters, they were, you know, in it for the long haul, looking for, you know, decades long signals at, you know, amplitudes of about 10 meters per second. And it was sort of this sort of grinded out kind of science. And as I'm sure most of you are aware, the first planet that was detected via this method was nothing at all like Jupiter. It was like Jupiter. It was about the mass of Jupiter, but it was on a 4-day orbit around its star. And the velocity amplitude was about 60 meters per second rather than 10 meters per second. So this is a whopping signal compared to what people were expecting to see. And I put this article up here. It's from 1996, just kind of a side note. I did like a little science report on this when I was in sixth grade on this first detected exoplanet, which I always like pointing that out. So this is a very young field, right? You know, of course, after the first few detections, people get more telescope time, there's more funding for this research, everyone gets excited, you know, finding planets. And, you know, over the next decade and a half, you know, hundreds more planets were found. This is both using this radial velocity method, but also using taking advantage of the fact that if you have just the right configuration of orbit of an exoplanet, then you might get lucky enough for the planet to actually pass in front of the star. And then if you're monitoring the brightness of the star over a period of time, you'll see these periodic dimmings that are due to the planet just blocking out a fraction of the light as it eclipses the star. And the magnitude of this effect for a Jupiter-sized planet and a sun-like star is about 1%. So this is a T-scale of a Jupiter in front of the sun. So it blocks out 1% of the sun's light. So over this decade and a half, this is what I call the giant age in exoplanet science, where we had these experiments. This Keck telescope in Hawaii, and this is the HARP spectrograph, which is on a telescope in Chile. And then this is a camera, 10-centimeter camera from one of the ground-based experiments looking for transiting planets. So lots of different kinds of ground-based experiments, but finding these hundreds of planets. But the thing to keep in mind is that only a very small fraction of the planets found in this first decade and a half were smaller than Neptune. So that's what this little faint light blue wedge in the middle here is, that represents the fraction of these systems that are less massive than Neptune. So all of the planets detected, nearly all of them in this age, were giant exoplanets. And we found out lots of interesting things about exoplanets, and this is sort of I think the most important things that were discovered in this first era. The first, of course, was just the mere existence of giant planets at orbits this short, where we don't expect that these planets could have formed there. And so this is, you know, both talking about, you know, 3 or 4 day orbits, but also 10, 15, 20, 50 day orbits. We don't think giant planets can form that close to the sun. In addition to their existence, these planets that were detected had significantly elliptical orbits. This is also something that we don't see in our solar system. All of the planets in our solar system are on nearly circular orbits. So that was surprising.
Reason for that? Is there a data selection effect, like you think that these, or is it physics reason you think that we are special?
You mean why do we not have elliptical planets?
Why is that the difference?
What this has shown us is, you know, about, you know, a few percent, 10% of stars have giant planets on these shortish orbits, and many of those systems have elliptical orbits. So, you know, there's not a strong selection bias toward discovering planets on eccentric orbits. There's a small one, but then there are also ways that you can miss planets if they're too eccentric. So it works both ways. But what this tells us is that, you know, our solar system is not a typical system like other systems that have short period giant planets. You know, like already having a short period giant planets is something completely foreign to our solar system. And the fact that many of those are also eccentric just kind of adds a puzzle.
So big ones are gas planets, right?
Yeah.
So the smaller ones, the ones that are smaller than Neptune, which you would assume that they're ones that would be closer to Earth, are those the ones that are those in systems that are similar to ours, or?
As of 2009, we didn't know at all. This is what the last few years have just been beginning to reveal.
Is that an age factor? These things get rounded out by quarks over time, presumably, right?
The time scales, well, you know, over infinite amount of time, yes. But the time scales for circularization for, you know, a planet, if it doesn't pass close to the star, then it's not going to circularize over the age of the universe. The tidal effects are such a strong function of separation. So what people think about, you know, how the hot Jupiters got there in 3 day orbits, they think maybe they started off on very eccentric orbits, and through close passages they're losing energy toward, you know, tidal effects, and then that's what shrinks the orbit. But if you have something that has a, you know, periastron passage of a tenth of an AU, that's going to be, even that is you know, it's going to be too slow. So these eccentricities are pretty much stuck there.
Unless there are gas disks.
Which there aren't in any of these planets. Yeah, these are all, you know, well-formed, mature systems. Yeah. So what happened in 2009, I started graduate school right about here. My second and third year of graduate school, some people made this really cool camera, multi-gigapixel camera, 42 CCDs, over this focal plane, and they put it on top of this huge missile and just like launched it into an Earth trailing orbit. And this is the Kepler mission. And every time I look at this, it blows my mind that like this extremely sensitive, you know, precise instrument just like goes on top of this huge rocket, and everyone's like cool with that. And yeah, this will work. This is the Kepler mission, launched in 2009. I was working for about 4 years, staring at a particular patch of sky near the constellation Cygnus. So this was 4 years of nearly continuous monitoring of about 200,000 stars in this field, and looking at the same patch of sky the whole time. And the method, of course, that it was looking for planets was via this transit method that I was telling you about earlier. And just to give a sense of the difference between what ground-based studies had done and what Kepler was able to do, again, this is what we could see from the ground. If you do really precise photometry over wide fields, you can detect you know, periodic dips of about 1%. This is Jupiter in front of the sun. And then if you can find Earth there somewhere, you might think it's that, but no, that's a star spot. That's Earth, the same size as a star spot. So you can get a sense of the challenges here. So the fractional dimming of an Earth passing in front of a sun is about 100 parts per million. This is 1 part in 10^4, right? So this is just photometry at an incredible level of precision, and Kepler is able to deliver that. So it's kind of hard to overstate how much Kepler has influenced exoplanet science, but this is kind of the one slide way to try to convey that.
Okay, yeah. So if you have the stars, I guess the stars in luminosity, is it, does it emit in a constant rate? Is it possible that you need to mix the signal with the sunspot?
Yeah, it's hard. So typically, you have a decent shot at disentangling sunspots from planets because it's different time scales. Well, so it's they're different time scales of signals, because so if you imagine our sun, it rotates at a 30-day period, right? And so you sort of have the signals from rotation happen all throughout the phase, right? So you get sort of slower signals, whereas transits are a much higher frequency. You know, it just said a couple hours, it goes across the face of the star. That being said, it's not always easy at the low signal to noise to distinguish between these two things. So that's one of the challenges of detection. So this is what I was showing you before, this wedge of pre-Kepler planets, you know, where the light blue were the small planets, smaller than Neptune, before Kepler. Orange is the planets that Kepler found, and the light orange is the planets that are smaller than Neptune from Kepler. So what this shows is that, you know, not only is the, you know, quantity of planets completely unprecedented, but also the character. It's opening a window into systems that we weren't able to observe at all before, and showing that what we were looking at prior to Kepler was really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the planets that are out there. So what we've learned from Kepler, just kind of a few bullet points, are that, you know, probably every star has planets. The data are consistent with that. There have been a couple more kind of Copernican ideas of planetary systems, showing that there are plenty of other kinds of systems other than our solar system. One of which is that Kepler has found multiple, you know, systems of multiple transiting planets where there are 4 or 5 planets all orbiting their stars closer than the orbit of Mercury. You know, we thought going into this that, you know, Mercury is a pretty short period planet, but there's tons of planets at shorter periods than that, and many of them within the same systems. In addition, we found qualitatively different kinds of planets as well. In our solar system, there's nothing between the size of Earth and Neptune. Neptune's about 4 times the size of Earth, and Kepler's found just gobs of planets, you know, 1.5, 2, 3 times the size of Earth. And so there's sort of a whole subfield of the study that is trying to understand, you know, what are the structures of these planets? What are they made of? Are they scaled up versions of Earth, like big rocks? Or are they scaled down versions of Neptune, like ice balls? Or are they, you know, scaled down versions of Jupiter, even with, you know, rocky core with hydrogen atmospheres? And, you know, probably all of these are true to some extent. And then the main goal of the Kepler mission was to try to determine how common habitable planets are, planets like the, you know, Earth around the sun. And this is something that we're sort of almost being able to say something about this. There have been studies that have sort of made some claims about this, but this is difficult and it is still a work in progress. Now, when I say, question?
Are these stars in any way correlated to the stars?
Meaning correlated in what way?
Yeah, like, smaller stars.
Not very strongly. So one thing that we do know is that less massive stars are less likely to host giant planets. So, you know, that's like, you know, half a solar mass star is unlikely to host a Jupiter-like planet, but sort of in the comparing, you know, occurrence rates of of super Earths to Earths, there doesn't seem to be a correlation with a stellar type. We know that the smaller planets are more common than the larger ones, but it's not strongly related to the kind of star.
Is that modulated by metallicity? Is that correlation is a real interesting?
Yeah. So what's interesting is that the correlation with metallicity for giant planets was very strong and was detected early on. So more metal-rich stars have more giant planets. That does not seem to be the case for the smaller planets. Yeah, so there's not any evidence that more metal-rich systems have more planets of the smaller kind. And it's complicated because we don't have detailed metallicities of all the Kepler stars. You know, people are working on this. So there might be some kind of subtle things that are still left to be discovered in that range, but it's definitely a different kind of effect than for giant planets.
So we have the question about the elliptic orbits.
Yep.
How do they, now that we have much more statistics, are we special still?
So we have very little information about the eccentricities of Kepler planets.
Okay.
And that's because the way we measure eccentricity for it, and I was telling you before, those are from radial velocity signals.
Okay.
And when you have a radial velocity curve of the planet, you can tell, you know, one of the parameters you measure is the eccentricity. When you just have the transit, you can get some information about eccentricity, but it's much harder. And it's very much tied to what the, you know, do I know the radius of the star correctly and things like that. So it's a harder problem. But there are people working on it where, you know, we're getting there.
So do you get some by measuring velocity as the transit happens?
Yes. So that's you can tell if you knew the stellar radius precisely, and you knew that it's in, then you would be able to tell from the period and the duration. You know, you're basically measuring the velocity of the star. You know, when it's eclipsing, and then you have some degeneracy between the orientation of the ellipse and, but. Yeah, there are these degeneracies, and we don't know the radii precisely. So the best we can do is within 10-15% when you have a spectrum. And for a lot of the Kepler stars, we don't have spectra.
Binary systems, binary stars?
That's an excellent question. Yes, and this is another complicating feature of the Kepler data that. I've been working on, and actually it's a whole subject that I'm not even touching in this talk. But I think that's one of the most interesting things about Kepler is that it's the first completely multiplicity blind exoplanet survey. So we're finding stars in binary systems and single systems, and then, you know, so there's a lot to be learned there.
What's the distance of the stars you observe? So the
Kepler stars are typically on the orders of hundreds of parsecs away. So, you know, 500 to 1,000 parsecs. So relatively distant, relatively faint. So I have a chance to move on a little bit. When I call this the sort of wedge of Kepler planets, I'm actually lying a little bit because, you know. More precisely, these are the Kepler planet candidates. And there's an important distinction between a planet and a planet candidate. And that's because when you do one of these surveys looking for transiting planets and you see a periodic dip in brightness of one of your stars, that might be a planet. It might also be something else. And this sort of something else is what I've been working on a lot since graduate school. And what happens is, you know, again, a planet could cause a signal, or any number of these astrophysical false positive scenarios could also cause a similar looking signal. You could have something that is much more massive, but the same size as a star. So, you know, a brown dwarf or a low mass star, the same size as a giant planet. You can also imagine a scenario where you have a eclipsing binary star here, where if you were just looking at the eclipsing binary, you might have, the secondary star would block 10% of the light of the primary. You'd know that was an eclipsing binary. But if that eclipsing binary only takes up, you know, maybe 10% of the photons in a photometric aperture that you're looking at, so you're looking at this target star, you think this is the only star there, but you actually have a hidden, you know, faint binary star within that same aperture that's dimming by a larger fraction relative to just the system. You put it all together, you have, you know, 10% of the light dimming by 10%, you get a 1% transit, something that looks just like a giant planet. You can have a similar situation if you have eclipsing binary star that just barely touches one another. They just barely touch one another. You get a very shallow eclipse. And on all of these can mimic planets.
Yeah, but light caps will be different, right?
I'm sorry?
I mean, in that case, a light cap, there will be a black.
That's right. Yeah, and I'll get that's part of one of the things that helps. Here, you know, you might.
But these are difficulties for extracting the data, but a binary system might have a completely different history for its planetary system, right? It's unstable, it might be quite unstable, yep. So far out of orbit.
Yeah, although actually one of the things I didn't mention about Kepler, one of the cool things that it's found is it's found planets orbiting eclipsing binaries. So there are these circumbinary, you know, Tatooine planets that have been found.
So the technical name?
Yes. So this is just to illustrate what I was talking about with these astrophysical false positives. You can have, so that the top signal is actually comes from a hierarchical triple stellar system where two of the components are eclipsing one another. You get a 1% dip that looks just like a transiting giant planet. And this is an actual Jupiter-sized planet. So this was a real, you know, this is basically the central problem of these wide-field ground-based transit surveys, you know, in this giant era of exoplanets. And they basically designed, you know, the paradigm of these whole experiments was based on you get a bunch of candidates and you sort of slowly whittle them down from follow-up observations to leave you with a small number of candidates that you can afford to spend the big telescope time to try to measure their masses. And so this is how all of these ground-based transit survey planets were found. And for every planet that was found, there were four or five false positives that were identified along the way. So this is a big problem, right? So in, you know, kind of, you know, leading up to Kepler, this is what people thought. This was the field. This is how you did a transiting planet survey. You found candidates. You followed them up. You figured out which ones were planets. So when Kepler comes along, it gives you this, which there are sort of three different things that make it completely impossible to sort of apply the same sort of funnel down method to the Kepler candidates. So the blue pluses are the transiting planets that were found from ground-based surveys prior to Kepler, and the orange circles are the Kepler candidates. So a few problems. One is that there are thousands of them. Just the quantity is overwhelming. They're around fainter stars, you know, typically by several magnitudes, which means that any individual observation takes a lot longer, is much more expensive to do. But, you know, even more fundamental problem is that these planets are predominantly around, you know, these candidates, if they were planets, the radio velocity signals are undetectable, even if you used literally every telescope in the world, you know, looking at these things, you would never be able to measure their masses because they're too small. The radio velocity signature of an Earth that Earth imparts on the Sun is on order of 10 centimeters per second. The vast majority of these are, you know, the infrared signal is on the order of tens of centimeters per second, which is just undetectable. So what this required was sort of a completely new way to think about how do we deal with a transit survey that we can't actually do follow-up to understand it. And this is exactly where I came in when I was in my third year of graduate school. And, you know, you have to apply inference to this problem. There's a lot of information that we know about, you know, astrophysics, eclipsing binary populations, all these things, and you can bring all of that and inform this question of whether these things are planets or not. And there's actually a pretty direct analogy with the sort of classic, you know, probability question of you stick your hand in a bag of marbles and you try to figure out, you know, is this marble going to be green or blue? If the only information that you have is that there are two colors of marbles in the bag, then the best guess that you can say is, you know, 50-50 chance that it's going to be green. And if someone tells you there's four green marbles and eight blue marbles, then you're like, okay, it's, you know, 1 in 3 chance it's going to be green. But if you have even more information and you can say that, okay, I know that 3/4 of all green marbles in the world are large, but only 1/4 of blue marbles are large, and you put your hand and you feel that it's a big marble, then you can do a better job and guess that, you know, there's a 3 out of 5 chance it's going to be green. And this is actually a direct analogy to what we're doing with these transiting planet signals. This is Bayes' equation, which is the foundation of this probabilistically justified inference that we do, and kind of, you know, replacing these generic symbols with ones that are relevant to the problem at hand. What we're basically doing here is a model selection between various hypotheses that could be creating these signals. So we have one hypothesis is that it's a planet, and the other hypotheses are these various different kinds of astrophysical false positives. And the goal of this work is to try to figure out, you know, what are these likelihood and prior functions that, you know, are relevant for each of these different models. So for the likelihood, the question is, you know, how much does the signal that you have look like this particular model? And the prior question is, how common is this thing to exist in the galaxy? And these, you know, this is something that, that we have plenty of you know, historical observational and theoretical work that sort of points us to be able to have justified answers to these questions. So this is just a summary of my work on this subject, starting with this first paper in 2011. It was published the same day, I put it on the archive the same day as the first Kepler public candidate catalog, which was very exciting for lots of people because they're like, okay, we don't have to think about false positives anymore. They're all planets, which is not exactly the message I was trying to send. But it was exciting to, you know, because people were sort of, you know, snake bit by this you know, false positive problem with ground based surveys, and there was no plan within the Kepler team as to how to deal with these false positives that you can't actually follow up. So this was, you know, I was coming in from this from the outside. I, you know, I had nothing to do with the Kepler team when I published this work.
Most of them are real planets.
Yeah, that's right. So 90 to 95% of the basis of the arguments that I was using here was that if you do all of the vetting that you can do using just the Kepler photometry, which is actually you can do a lot, then you actually don't need follow up to be able to get it down to this small.
How would you observation? You say you cannot confirm observation.
Yeah.
I think you're kind of mapping, have some idea.
Yeah, sure. So theoretically, basically.
Yeah. How do we have any?
Yeah, so it's hard. It takes a lot of work, and you only do it on small samples of candidates. But there are two different studies.
Yeah. What do you mean small? What do you mean compared to the large?
Meaning compared to the large numbers of candidates. So, for example, there was a study that took many years using the Spitzer Space Telescope to look for color-dependent transits. So to measure, if you measure the transit in the Spitzer bands and the Kepler band and at the same depth, then you know it's unlikely that it's an eclipsing binary star because you would expect a color-dependent transit. So they did that with like 50. And it took a long time. There's lots of work, lots of observations, and they found like no false positives. So that was one observational confirmation. And then there's another work that has been looking at basically all of the bright star large planet candidates with radial velocities. This is led by a European group. And they've been sort of weeding, you know, figuring out which of these signals are eclipsing binaries, which of them are blended eclipsing binaries. And they match up very well with what I predict, with what each one should be. And I have a slide I could show more about that. So sort of moving on from that first work, I kind of extended this analysis to look more in individually at individual candidates, you know, taking more information about the shapes of the signals into account. Like you were saying, planets tend to be more boxy. I'll talk about that, you know, in just the next slide. And this has been used to, you know, validate many of the Kepler planets, meaning demonstrate that the probability of it being a false positive is very low. And then I've, you know, over the last year especially, I've been sort of putting together this work and, you know, packaging it in these open source Python packages that other groups have been using throughout the field, which is fun. So just getting in just real quickly about sort of how, you know, what I, you know, how these things work, you know, the, you know, one of the bases of this analysis is that typically, planet and eclipsing binary light curves don't look exactly the same. So on average, planet signals are more boxy. So if you simulate a population of, hierarchical eclipsing binaries and planets. This is sort of different projections in this three-dimensional trapezoidal shape parameter space. They sort of occupy different regions. And especially down here, this is this 2 over tau parameter, which is the total duration over the partial. So if this equals 2, then it's a perfectly V-shaped. So this planet will tend to be more boxy, and the eclipsing binaries are more V-shaped. So applying this to an actual signal, here's a, KOI 7. The red X is, the measured shape of the signal, and these are what is predicted from the planet model, and then the various false positive models. None of them do a good job of explaining the shape of the signal.
What do you do with limb darkening?
So limb darkening is built into the models here. When I simulate these populations of eclipsing things, I simulate them including limb darkening and everything, and then I fit those with this sort of empirical trapezoid model just to put everything on the same footing. So I'm using the same.
Is it known for all stars?
It's known pretty well. They're good models that, when you get down to the nitty gritty of like super high signal to noise ratio signals, then there can be some issues with limb darkening. But these are all stellar atmospheric calculations do a pretty good job of predicting what limb darkening should be. So when you put these things together, you have the sort of likelihoods, how well do the shapes agree with the models, and then you have the priors of how common do we expect these different models to be. You put these all together, and for this particular planet, there's less than 1 in a million chance that this could be caused by a false positive. Just to take a different example, here is one of the signals that was from one of these follow-up observations determined to be an eclipsing binary. So this is a false positive. You can kind of eyeball it and be like, it looks like a star, which people do, but it's nice to be able to put numbers on this, right? So here's the planet explanation, which again, it works. If you have a planet this size, it could create a signal like this. But what's important about this is that these false positive scenarios also do a very good job of explaining this shape. And when you combine that with the priors of how common you expect these things to be, and how rare you expect giant planets to be, so all of this is built into this, that you get a false positive probability of greater than 50% for this case, and this turns out to be an actual false positive.
Can you show me specific physical model in this?
There are a couple of things that are fixed in what I'm describing here. Things like the mass ratio distribution of binary stars, eccentricity distribution.
Yes. So how sensitive are you to this? I mean, if you take, for example, the recent discovery of emerging black holes, no one was predicting that you would get so massive black holes. So how sensitive are you to such a thing?
There are some factors that are sort of, you can assess that trivially, where, for example, the sky density of stars in a particular line of sight is one of the parameters that goes into how likely are you to get a random alignment, right?
Probably, I know, but I want to see, because now we're talking about planets, right?
We know well. So there are a couple of things. One is that the entire Kepler data set tells you something about how common planets are, and you can sort of fold that in on itself. You can start off with like a I'm going to say that I know nothing about how common planets are, and then start with that, figure out what the probabilities are, and then what the occurrence rate is, and then adjust it, and that sort of thing converges in like one iteration. So it's.
The question is, Kepler is looking at a very specific part of the sky. So what is that part of the sky special?
Then everything that I'm telling you right now is about that particular patch of the sky. It's all.
There must be a reason though why they pick that patch of the sky. So what is the reason?
Sure. So it was. There are different kinds of reasons. Some scientific, some political. Political being, it's in the northern hemisphere, meaning Keck can observe it, but the southern hemisphere telescopes can't.
Australians cannot see that.
Yeah, that's right. So you can't see it very well from Chile. But more importantly than that is it was chosen to have, you want a high enough density of stars that you have a lot of target stars, but you don't want it too high that you have crowding issues and that you have lots of background. So it's basically pointing about roughly 10 or 12 degrees off of the galactic plane.
I see.
So that's the main design. It's in, I think it's sort of tangential. So the volume that it probes is mostly like, you know, order 500 parsecs. So it's not really very sensitive to like galactic structure as a whole. But you know, and it is a valid point that, you know, this is a particular part of the galaxy that we're looking in. And you know, if this is, yeah.
No, I'm just curious.
It's an interesting question, and you know, future surveys will be looking elsewhere, and we'll see if there's anything special.
What's the selection towards what stars can you see? I mean, is it over radius, lower bound for a radius of the star?
So the Kepler experiment was designed. It was unfortunate that we can only download data from 200,000 postage stamps, pixels. So there are like 6 million stars in the field, but we can only get data for about 200,000 target stars. And so those target stars were selected to be as sun-like as possible. So it's all of the bright sun-like stars, and then kind of going down in brightness a little bit to like the fainter stars. So there are, you know, for example, M-dwarf stars, you know, low-mass stars were not very well represented in the Kepler target list. However, even those small numbers of stars that were there produced lots of planets, so we were able to learn things about that. There's sort of this weird like target selection effects that go into everything that Kepler's done. These are all of the candidates from the Kepler, most recent Kepler catalog. And what I've done with my false positive analysis is I've applied, and this is a, you know, completely automated routine that I've run on all of these candidates, and it's able to turn this into this. Here I've shaded by the false positive probability, so I've kind of faded out the things that are most likely to be false positives.
And you could have made your points a little bit smaller.
Yeah, I know. There's all sorts of, you know, I was designing this for a paper, and you know, there's all sorts of. Anyway, I could have made them smaller. There's lots of things in here, I promise, right? but the main effect here is, you know, you actually see these interesting part of parameter space kind of pop out there, and that these are probably planets, where you couldn't really see that from here, right? And this actually matches up very well with the kind of period distribution and size distribution that we see from the ground-based transit surveys. So those are the planets that have been found.
One guy. First
man
is 0.
9876543. So this is, you know, it's a log scale. So it's, you know, 10 to the 0.3 days. This is actually this was found in a different method as the other ones. The actual Kepler detection, like the official Kepler detection pipeline, stopped it, cut off at a half day. Orbit, so that's this. And then this was found by someone else who was like using their own way, and they followed it up with radial velocities and got a measurement and everything, which is cool. This is Kepler 78b or something, I think it's found.
Where is the speech?
This?
No, where is
the? Oh, yeah, that's coming. Right here. There's a slide with an arrow and a couple slides. I may not get through everything. I didn't put on this plot. It's coming.
It wasn't detected by Kepler.
this work is this is going to be published very soon, and in a couple weeks, NASA is actually going to do a big press release where they're like, "We discovered 1,200 new planets," and that's where this comes from. So this is more than doubling the number of known planets in the Kepler survey. If there's any like news people watching recordings of this, just wait till the press release is out. don't go to the blogs on this yet. I know. That's why I'm actually talking. I'm serious. Just wait.
Can't you blend it out the frames?
So again.
Go back to the power.
Yeah, this one.
What's the distinction between false positive and false positive positive?
Right, right, right. So the Kepler, there are all these, I mentioned the vetting procedures that happen within Kepler.
Oh.
You know, there are things that you can do, like, oh, I found that there's a secondary eclipse in here. So that's a false positive. I see that there's a centroid offset during transit. So it's due to something that's not coincident with the target. So so my code is now it's a step after the vetting process. So the vetting process, this identifies things that it's sort of, it's complementary to what I do, because I assume in my calculations that all of these tests have passed, which basically it localizes it onto a particular area of the CCD. It says that, oh, there's no secondary eclipse down to this limit. So all of those constraints go into my calculations. So that's the answer there. So these are things that were confirmed previously via other methods. So I'm more than doubling that here. With this arbitrary 1% cutoff, you know, gotta do that somewhere.
What happened in the calculation
panel?
I was curious.
different things. Some of which are a lot of these were actually things that turned out not to be even eclipse-like signals. So like the trapezoid fit didn't converge. Things like that. Yeah. So probably most of these things are actually not planets. Yeah. We have this great, you know, plot, but you know what we want to do is we want to do more science with this. We want to know what is the underlying period and radius distribution of planets. And here's that arrow we were wanting before. You know, in particular, we're interested in Earth. You know, how common are Earth-like planets? And this is, again, was one of the goals of the Kepler mission. So, one of the studies that has been very widely cited and did a lot of great work towards answering this question was a study by Eric Pettigura in 2014. And what he did that hadn't been done before by the Kepler team was, so he made his own detection pipeline based on the Kepler data and looking for transit signals. And then he was able to quantify the detection efficiency of that pipeline via injection recovery simulations. So this is something that, you know, sort of is something that you think should definitely be done, right? Kepler team hadn't done it at this point, and Eric did, and so he was able to come up with this, you know, estimates of the occurrence rates of planets down, you know, and sort of correcting for things that you would have expect, you know, have a low detection efficiency and things like that. And the big conclusion of this work was that this was in the summary of the paper in PNAS was like, we find that 22% of sun-like stars harbor Earth-sized planets orbiting their habitable zone.
So habitable zone.
Yeah.
You're saying you don't have a lot of information about eccentricity, right?
That's like one of about 1,000 things that we could talk about. Let me just go ahead and just jump to this, okay? The most obvious thing, actually, just right off the bat, without even worrying about eccentricity, stellar activity, all these things, is this box that, you know, in which was claimed 22% was from 1/4 to 4 times the insulation that Earth receives. And nobody anywhere thinks that this is actually a habitable zone. So, you know, in the paper, it was very clear that this is what they were doing, but, you know, what it came out in the press is that habitable zone, 22%. And not only in the press, it's actually, this is in the summary in the journal.
The 1/4 to 4, no one believes it. So what is it that people believe is the habitable zone?
Within like point, some people put the Earth out of the habitable zone. Whoops, or like right on the edge, right?
Okay,
so,
yeah.
What's that?
What criteria? This is just.
There's a lot of things that go into these calculations, yeah. But it's usually something like 0.9 to 1.1 ish, just around that order. Definitely not 1/4 to 4. Like, this is just absurd to call it habitable. But so.
I guess it's habitable 1.1.
Yes. This criteria. So the typical criteria is to have something where liquid water could exist on the surface. But even that, you know, this is a whole other conversation. But what is, you know, more interestingly, kind of from a methods standpoint, is that also this 22% is also questionable. And that's because, as you see here, like we're kind of right on the boundary of detectability here. And also this is extrapolating. So there's a lot of subtleties that go into doing this properly. And in a work with Daniel Forman-Mackey and David Hogg at NYU, like a couple years ago, we took this exact data set, redid the occurrence rate analysis, and came up with a significantly different answer, which was, you know, this is the evaluation of the density, you know, in this period radius space at the location of Earth. And this is what was from the previous study. This is what they claimed, and this is what the inference tells us. And there are a couple things that that make this contribute to this difference. And these are the two big ones. One is that, you know, we sort of did a much more conservative extrapolation. So sort of we said that all we're going to say is that the distribution is smooth. This previous work had done was assumed, okay, it's a log flat distribution. We're going to say that this continues to be log flat out to 400 day orbits. There's no evidence for that. So we're incorporating, the reason our uncertainties are much larger is because we're incorporating that uncertainty. And then also the uncertainties in planet radius are actually comparable to the bin sizes that we're talking about here. So that has to be incorporated in a sort of hierarchical inference kind of way.
So just yeah. Gamma.
Yeah, so gamma is the, it's the rate density function in period radius space. So gamma Earth is evaluating that density function at the location of Earth. Okay. It's not integrating over a bin, over some arbitrary bin.
Units of gamma?
This is per log planet radius per log period. So it's, you know, it's a.
Am I to say roughly speaking, the probability that Earth-like planet is squeezed in -4?
So what this comes out to is about yeah. So it's like, you know, it's something like 2%. Yeah, 1%, 2% per log interval. So to turn this into, it's still, you know, they're probably there. You know, so this is interesting, right? It's non-zero most likely. So just to continue, I have this slot is until like 12:30. I don't want to go all the way.
90 minutes, I think, 1 hour for the job, and then still have a question.
Okay.
People ask questions now, then.
Sure.
You have to extrapolate a little bit to make statements about what happens when you evaluate at the Earth's mass, right?
You definitely have to extrapolate. So what we did was we said, we don't know exactly what the shape of this is going to look like. We're going to allow for, you know, flexible shape, but, you know, sort of constrained to be smooth, and sort of incorporate that uncertainty into this analysis. And so that's what gives us our bigger error bars. And then the other thing.
I mean, no one would really believe that this is the case, but if let's say that there was some.
Yeah, if there was just off a cliff, then we'd be wrong.
It doesn't go to zero, totally. Because we're here somewhere between 1 and 2.
We wouldn't be able to tell that. Yeah. So just to move on, and this is kind of going on this, what it means to incorporate uncertainties into a kind of population analysis like this. Changing gears a little bit into looking at the distribution of orbital properties of stars. So this is getting back to when we talked about eccentricities before, but now this is looking at inclinations of planetary orbits. And this is something that's not directly observable, there is sort of a proxy that we can use for inclination, which is the angle between a star's spin axis and the planetary orbital axis, which is not technically inclination, but we can't say anything about an invariant plane of exoplanet systems. So, you know, this is kind of the best we can do. And, you know, this is what the sort of eccentricity semi-major axis distribution looks like for planets with measured eccentricities. So there's this whole wide range of eccentricities, things that we don't see in our solar system. And this points to things, suggests that, you know, multi-body dynamics, interactions between planets has been important in the shaping of these planetary systems. So we'd like to say something similar about, you know, try to use information about inclination to help us, think about how systems form and evolve. So the.
How do you measure the spin axis of the star?
You measure the relative direction of the spin axis in the planetary orbit. And there are a couple ways to do that, and this is one of them. So one that has been used the most to, you know, several dozens of exoplanet systems is by using what's called the Rossiter-McLaughlin effect. And what this is you have a transiting planet, you take, make radial velocity measurements of the system while the planet is transiting. You have a rotating star. the planet blocks part of the blue-shifted side, part of the red-shifted side of the star. You can get these anomalous blue-shift and red-shift. And from the shape and symmetry of what the shape looks like, you can tell if the planet is well-aligned with the spin axis or not. So this is an example that's perfectly aligned. It blocks the blue-shifted side first and then the red-shifted side. There are planets that have been seen to be backwards, so they are orbiting retrograde relative to their star spin. There are planets in polar orbits, all sorts of things. Using this Rossiter-McLaughlin effect, this has been done. You can only do this with hot Jupiter planets, basically, because you need a bright star, you need a large planet, you need a short orbit. So this kind of forces you to only study, just this very tail of the distribution of planets. And what we want to know is, with the Kepler planets, what are the obliquities of these guys? And this is much harder. But one thing that we can do is we can take advantage of the fact that I think we were talking about before with these star spots, that stars rotate, and that if you look at the time series, the flux time series of these Kepler stars, you can, for many of them, you can back out rotation periods. And this comes from, there are these dark areas of the star that come in and out of view, and the overall flux varies with a sort of quasi-periodic manner, and you can come up with a rotation period. And if you can combine that with a spectrum of the star that gives you the radius of the star and a projected rotational velocity that you can get from the broadening of the spectral absorption lines, you can put these together to get some idea of what's the inclination of the star's spin axis along the line of sight. And then if you have a transiting planet, you know that's edge-on. So if you can say that the star is inclined, then you have a highly oblique system. So this is something that people had thought about a little bit before and done some work on, but everyone pretty much ran into the barrier in the fact that with realistic data, this is sort of what this inference looks like for any individual system. You can measure radius to about 10%, you get V sine I to about 0.5 km/s, and you put this together and it gives you like this kind of constraint on the inclination of the star, which no one would consider that a detection of anything. You have this very broad posterior for what the inclination could be. But what you have to do then is you have to use this, what I called hierarchical inference, where you can actually make statements about population distributions of certain quantities when all you have are these sort of probabilistic constraints on the individual level. And this is this is something that is relevant in many fields of study. And I applied this to this obliquity question. And the way I parameterized this was, imagine the obliquity distribution as this Fisher distribution. It's like a normal distribution on a sphere with a single parameter, where as the kappa goes to zero, it turns into an isotropic distribution. Kappa gets very large, it becomes very tight. the goal, you can get probabilistic constraints on the population distribution of this kappa value given a set of these radius and rotation period measurements. And so I took a population of, there are 70 stars, this data was all public, and I split them between, these are all Kepler host stars that have measured rotation periods and have high resolution spectra available. And I split them between stars that show a single transiting planet and ones that show multiple transiting planets. What we saw was that the single transiting planets prefer much lower values of kappa than the systems with multiple transiting planets. So this is drawing from the median of these distributions, what the obliquity distribution looks like for those different values of kappa. So what this says is that the multis tend to be much more well aligned with their stellar spins, and the singles tend to be more inclined. And I've followed this up with sort of more data that we have. This what was like a 2 sigma difference is becoming more significant, and this is not yet published, but it's continuing to suggest that there could be a difference in population between the single transiting systems and multiple transiting systems. And this is one explanation. This is not necessarily the only explanation of what's going on, but what you might think is that where you see multiple transiting planets, you know, these are maybe dynamically cold systems that are all very flat, and you see multiple transiting planets because they're all orbiting in the same plane. And systems where you only see one planet eclipsing, it's not because there's only one planet in the system. It could be because the planets have significant mutual inclinations with respect to one another. And so that would naturally lead to a larger distribution of obliquities. So this is one possible explanation. This is a good example of something that, you know, answering the scientific question actually required the kind of the next level of digging into the analysis to be able to do. So there's a lot more still to do with Kepler, and I'm working on, in some manner, and on all of these things currently. One thing I want to highlight here, I'm not going to talk about all of this, one thing I want to highlight is that we can actually learn a lot about stellar binary populations from Kepler data. And this, I don't think, has been exploited very much yet. So one thing I'm particularly interested in is, you know, rather than sort of fixing the properties of the binary population from what we had before, use actual Kepler data to inform what is the period distribution, eccentricity distribution of binary stars. And this is something that is scientifically interesting also, you know, beyond just exoplanets. And especially getting into kind of the next stage of what the next decade or so is going to look like in this field, you know, you have these, so the TESS is the next generation NASA space telescope to look for exoplanets. That's going to find tens of thousands of planets and hundreds of thousands of eclipsing binary stars. And then we have Gaia and LSST that will return millions of binary star systems as well. So there's really a lot to be, you know, there's a lot to be revealed about populations of both planets and eclipsing binary stars. questions on, about any of these? Yeah.
So the Gaia. So all of your guys will now have accurate parallaxes, correct?
Yes.
From Gaia.
Yes.
How are these parallaxes affected by the dynamics? Just from, you know, that you're so sensitive to planets of such a wide range of mass. Does that all get filtered out?
So when they fit, so parallax, unless a significant number of, so the parallax measurements can be complicated if you have, you know, like a binary star system where you have to solve for both the binary orbit and the parallax and proper motion. Yeah, but so most of the things, so most of the planets, the large majority of the planets, we know all the planets are concentrated towards smaller sizes. Those are not massive enough to make significant astrometric signals in Gaia. What Gaia will find is long period giant planets and tens of thousands of them, but they won't really be affected by the planets that we see in Kepler.
What about smaller planets, planets? Most of things are very big.
Yeah, that's right. Most of what will happen here will actually be having to do with larger planets. Mm-hmm. This is going to be looking for the smallest planets around the brightest stars with radial velocities. That's, you know, another aspect of the future. But in terms of you know, finding, you know, what are the frequency of small planets around stars, mm-hmm. we're not going to do better than we've done with Kepler. And until, I guess, maybe Plato is a European mission that's, you know, again, decades timescale, it might be comparable.
What about, do they have, how much information, reliable information they have about the atmospheres? Because that's even now.
Yeah, right. So almost all of the Kepler, pretty much all of the Kepler planets are on, the stars are too faint to be able to get any good atmospheric measurements. And that's the real goal of the TESS mission is, whereas Kepler was the sort of narrow, deep survey, TESS is the shallow, wide, when it's gonna be looking at all the bright stars, whole sky survey, 30 days at a time, it'll find all the short period planets transiting bright stars. And those will be the ones that we'll be able to follow it up with, you know, JWST for atmospheric study. Just to sort of finish up and kind of have the coda here, you know, this is, you know, the what we use to do this work in exoplanets. It's also relevant to a lot of the science that you guys think about here. So, you know, there's a very direct parallel with, you know, imagining in the next 5 years of gravitational wave data. We're going to be seeing populations of black holes, populations of neutron stars merging. And we're going to want to do things like, what is the mass function of black holes? What is the mass function of neutron stars? And you know, this it could not be a more direct parallel with the kinds of questions that we have to do with Kepler, where we're trying to do population inference on things where we only have these probabilistic constraints and relatively small numbers of them. The numbers will be increasing, but it'll still be dozens in the next few years. And then also sort of scientifically more directly is that the progenitor populations of these things that we're interested in with LIGO, are, these are the kind of things that will, that the data from Gaia, or more maybe JWST and TESS, will be able to tell us something about, eclipsing binaries and massive stars.
So the data, the slide you showed before, actually, will those be, will this be galactic observations, or will they go up high seas too?
No, so
be able to see only...
Yeah, so there's actually a paper that claims that LSST might be able to detect hot Jupiters in the Large Magellanic Cloud. But that's kind of the most that people are trying to put. And even that, I think, the blending, I think, is kind of hopeless there. Right? So gravitational waves, again, has these parallels. Also this, interest in fast radio bursts. I know you guys chime thinking about this stuff. There's these questions of, again, very parallel to Kepler. In order to quantify these populations, you need to know very carefully what is the sensitivity of your detection algorithms, especially at the lower signal to noise, to try to understand what's the luminosity function of these signals. And then, eventually going to answer questions like, are there multiple populations of these things? Are there, multiple kinds of, neutron stars that are producing these? Or maybe there are some of them that are different from mergers or something. And then just to finish up, cosmology, both with CMB and large-scale structure, there are problems, the next generation of CMB experiments will most likely be very limited by our understanding of the galactic foregrounds. And so this has at least a philosophical parallel with, this Kepler work, in that, we sort of have to, think about how are we going to model the nuisance sector, right? Are we going to try to just like subtract what we think is the signal and then fit the cosmology on that, or are we going to try to do a joint fit of everything and figure out how that works? And that's a hard problem for the CMB. And then the difficult thing in large scale structure is, what do we do when things get nonlinear? And there are sort of parallels with what I've been thinking about with the inference with the planet and star populations, in that there are ways to do what's called likelihood-free inference, which is a way to do inference where you can't actually write down a likelihood function analytically. So using simulations to try to match, data, sort of reduce statistics of your data, comparing simulations to actual data to do some justified inference. So that's something that could be. So this is, what the next 10 years is going to look like, and, are we going to go up or down? All these questions are will require these tools of inference, and I'll just leave it here and take any more questions that you guys have.
Might be naive, the question, but does the data in Kepler also have exoplanets around binary star systems? I mean, around a single star of a binary system.
Mm-hmm.
Do they differentiate? I mean, they should know which ones are.
Yeah, they don't.
They don't?
They don't, yeah. So this is one of the, what I think is one of the very interesting questions, is that for the first time we're actually sensitive to being able to detect, are there differences in planetary formation outcomes when you have single and binary stars? And so one of the things that I didn't even talk about here is that I'm involved with this study that uses the first ever robotic adaptive optics system that has imaged almost all of the Kepler candidates, Kepler planets, at high resolution in the optical. And so we found 500 binary companions in this. So there's a lot of people that are interested. Yeah, exactly. So this is one of the things I'm interested in, is to try to figure out, are there differences in the planetary populations between single and binary stars? And we don't know yet. Yeah.
Have you thought about including radial velocity
likelihoods in your analysis for questions?
Yeah, right. So this is, you know, my like dream thing to do is so part of the problem with radial velocities is that the culture is very closed. Like, you know, people don't publish their catalogs of all the radial velocity measurements that they've done, right? So, you know, when they publish planets, they'll publish the velocities of the stars that have planets in their orbits. But what you really want to know in order to be able to do this kind of work is you want to know the entire survey. You need to know, like, you know, what are the non-detections? What are the detections? You need all the data to be able to do that. So it's something that I'm very interested in, and you know, is I think especially in the tests era, where we'll actually be able to do radial velocities and transits on the same stars, you know, which hasn't been possible really up till now, you know, because the Kepler stars are so faint. You know, there have been isolated circumstances where you can do that, but for tests, it's going to be much easier to try to understand kind of the system as a whole. yeah.
A fraction of the sky could be located with the same sensitivity, just repeating the experiment. How often could you repeat it in the direction?
With Kepler?
Yeah.
So 400 times. So it's 100 square degrees, or is that 40? No, 100. 400. So, you know, 40,000 square degrees from 100. The Kepler field is 100 square degrees. I think Plato is looking to do a much larger field of view, maybe, and have several different pointings. And also, one of the big things that hindered Kepler actually is the fact that they were only downloading postage stamps and not the full frame images.
Say that again.
The fact that Kepler was only downloading these postage stamps of pixels around the target stars,
yeah,
rather than the full frame images. So it was taking these postage stamp, it was downloading the postage stamp data every 30 minutes, but that just threw away most of the pixels, and a lot of the like the issues with, you know, eclipsing binary blends and stuff would have been much easier if you had the entire field of view. And so TESS is going to have full frame images every 30 minutes, and it's going to have postage stamps of target stars every 2 minutes. So there's going to be a lot more data.
Would it be easier to detect Earth size for smaller planets if you have a smaller star?
Yeah. So all of the smallest planets that have been detected in Kepler have been around the very smallest, there's something like 3,000 stars about half solar radius or smaller that Kepler has.
Change your selection, but you're going to do that.
Yeah. So TESS is going to be doing that. So TESS is intentionally creating, you know, its target list to sort of weight towards the smaller stars. Because what TESS is going to hope is, you know, to try to find a potentially habitable planet around a low mass star that can be followed up via spectroscopy with JWST. So that's the dream of everybody.
When you talk about low mass stars, you mean even light
brighter
than the sun?
Yeah. I mean like half a solar mass or smaller. 0.2, 0.3. There's one particular system that I was involved in. Its discovery was it's like a 0.15 solar mass star that has three planets on like 0.5, 1.3, and 1.8 day orbits. It's basically like Jupiter with its moons,
yeah,
but an M dwarf star with planets around it, and those things are actually relatively common. There are so few of those stars that made the target, that were on the target Kepler target list, that the fact that we found a couple of them means that they're pretty common.
What is it? Okay. Well,
yeah.
Maybe it's getting too late.
It's up to you guys. You leave whenever you want. Talk to me.
So what is the creation of light and mass stars compared to the sun?
Ah, that's a good question. So about 75% of the stars in the solar neighborhood are these like low mass stars. So the majority of stars in the galaxy are these, you know, things lighter than half a solar mass.
And they have low luminosity too.
And they have low luminosity. That's right. Yeah. They're faint. So they're difficult to follow up with radial velocity. They haven't been, for the most part, surveyed. So people are working on, for example, building radial velocity instruments in the infrared, mm-hmm, to try to do better at monitoring these stars.
How does the number of planets go with the, do you have any idea about statistics of this sort? The number of planets is a function of the mass of the star, or
Yeah.
So if what Kepler, so most of the planets are from different, completely different systems, or are they, do you discover, you said one that you mentioned had three.
Oh, there are some stars that have seven planets, you know, around the same star.
How rare are they? Do you guys have any idea when you do this statistic? Do you guys have any idea of this type of questions too?
That's one of the questions that has not been answered quite yet. I mean, so we know that they're common enough that we see a lot of them, but in terms of, like, you know, most of the sort of population models that people are trying to fit are a single you know, monolithic, to try to fit the entire population that we see with a single distribution of, so chances are there's probably these, like, different kinds of populations, maybe some that are flat, some that are more highly dynamical. But yeah, and I think at the beginning you were asking about, there are some hints that lower mass stars have, the planets are more common than sun-like stars. And that's, again, just from the fact that they're such a small fraction of the Kepler target stars, but there, you know, there's a lot of signals that they've detected there. So I did a paper that was estimating there's approximately two planets per low mass star out to like 150 day orbits. Mm-hmm. That's just based on the Kepler data, and out to four Earth radii.
You have a multi-planet star.
Mm-hmm.
What is the range of inclination these multi-planets can have in order for them?
Yeah, pretty small. Pretty small. So people have used the data from Kepler, you know, looking at the relative numbers of 2, 3, and 4 planet systems to say that the typical relative inclinations, it can't be more than a few degrees, like 1 or 2 degrees, in order to get all of them happen to be eclipsing.
So actually, could one say that perhaps, I mean, with further analysis, Kepler actually corroborates rather old planetary models. Okay?
Yeah, that's right. So with the exception that we're seeing all of these planets that we don't know what they're made of, and we don't think they could have formed where we see them.
Assuming that there are collisions.
Right, so it might actually be that circular, you know, low inclination systems might be more common than the crazy ones, there's still questions of, you know, how do we make planets this big, that many of them so close to the star?
Yeah.
Some people are saying you can form them where
that's
we see
also
them.
Also, the same question where you can get black holes, right? Yeah. So close to each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep. Cool. All right. Well, I guess I should probably let you guys go. Feel free to ask me if you have any more questions. Yeah, I'm in 353 if I'm not talking with someone else. So I have a schedule, but okay.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, guys.